Welcome to Australia's Fiercely Independent Property Podcast.
Residential property is the only asset class we live in. It is where we raise our families, and it's our most expensive investment, yet property advice remains unregulated.
Listen to three pioneers of the property industry, each with diverse areas of expertise in property planning, buying, and education.
We'll distill the raw truth from the ill-informed.
Join the property planner, David Johnston, the property buyer, Kate Bakos.
That's me.
And the property professor, Peter Kalizos, as we take you on a journey through the maze of property, mortgage and money decisions to empower you to create your ideal lifestyle.
Hello and welcome to the Property Planner, Buyer and Professor podcast once again. Great to have your company and also the company of my two great hosts, Dave Johnston and Kate Bakos. Dave, how are you?
I'm really well, thanks, Pete.
Excellent.
I tend not to give too much of an update on my week. I can never remember the details.
Pete asks you a close question and all you say is I'm good or I'm well. Pete, you've got to say, mate, what did you eat last night?
I'm a bloke.
I was just going to say, typical bloke, typical bloke. Kate, how are you?
I'm having a good week. It's a funny one because as we're reading and hearing, there's a lot of subtle change in the property market, but my market update will lead into explaining what's going on, if you want me to launch into it now.
Sure, and then I'll get into Dave's market update.
Next segue. We go. Before we get into today's episode, take a listen to our weekly market update. All right, we're seeing a lot of properties passing in and selling immediately afterwards. That's certainly happening in my neck of the woods. And we're also seeing, you know, slightly lower auction clearance rates. But let's not jump at shadows. The auction clearance rates are still in the 70s, which by anyone's measure is still a seller's market. It's just not a crazy seller's market anymore. But what's really interesting is with all of the global unrest and upset, you know, concern for what's going on in Ukraine, with the federal election looming and with talk of interest rate rises, you'd imagine that people are feeling pretty jittery. However, we've had the largest number of auctions occur in our city in the last week for the whole year. We've got record high new listing numbers nationally, and we still have clearance rates that are pretty strong. So what that says to me is despite the fact that there's a little bit of supply and demand imbalance that's changed from last year when it was crazy, it's still pretty strong. There's still enough demand, and well, it's actually more demand than supply. So if there's opportunities out there now where properties are passing in more readily or vendors are more prepared to take reasonable prices before auction, buyers need to recognise that this might be that window that they've been sitting around hoping for and waiting for a year.
Excellent. Very good. Thanks for that, Kate. Excellent segue from your what's happening on the weekend to your market update. Dave, how about you?
What I was going to touch on, I've been providing commentary since around the middle of last year, or probably even prior to that, around fixed rates and why they were so low, why in particular the three-year fixed rate, which the government had focused on keeping at record low levels for the first time for as long as I could remember, they'd been consistently lower than the super discounted variable rates. Well, that's well and truly switched now. So we're back into more of a normal interest rate market where you're paying less for the discounted variable rates than your three-year fixed rates. So we've seen big changes over that period and particularly speeding up in the last few months, whereby the three-year bond yield has jumped even further. And I won't go into the specifics. I might save it for our monthly market update. But now it's back to more of a normal, historically normal interest rate market where you'd pay less for the discounted variable rate than you do for the three-year fixed rate.
Excellent. Yeah, so you're right, because you normally pay a premium for a fixed rate, but things have been a bit skewed recently. All right, so we're getting back to normal. If I could just give a quick market update, as we're all fans of CoreLogic, keeping in mind we don't get any sponsorship from anyone. But
we're trying, aren't we, Pete?
Having said that, you know, Andy Muir, who's in charge of CoreLogic in South Australia, Northern Territory, you know, a free T-shirt wouldn't go astray, mate, or maybe an umbrella. I remember you gave me an umbrella 15 years ago when we first started using CoreLogic in our courses.
But you can never have too many umbrellas, that's for sure. They always go missing.
They do. But I'm really impressed with their updated website because right at the bottom they've got a great way to view their stats before they just had this rolling screen across the bottom, and then you, to get more detail, you need to go to another page. But in particular, the 20-day rolling average really tells a story. So what we've got in October, all the capital cities from April till October seem to be going the same way. That was going down. Then in October, Brisbane and Adelaide went up. The other capital cities kept going down. Then around mid-December to mid-January, everybody went down again. And then at the end of January, Brisbane and Adelaide went back up. The rest of the capital cities kept going down. But graphically, it's a great way to show what is happening in the five major capital cities. So whoever runs the CoreLogic website, well done. I think that's a big positive plus there. It gives the average punter an excellent idea of what's happening in the different markets.
Great update, Pete. And just to clarify, because I certainly haven't explained this as well at times in the past, going down means the rate of growth has been decelerating, but it's still been growing. Property values have still been growing, but at a slower rate.
We love hearing from our listeners and we'd love to tackle more of your questions. So please, if you have any on your mind, no matter how great or small, send us a message. You can email us info@propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor or go to our website, Facebook page, or simply click on the link in your podcast app under the play button and fill out our online form.
So today is one of those episodes where we look at some listener questions, and we love getting listener questions. We have a few today. I'm not sure how many we'll get through, but we'll start with the first one, which is on vendor advocates. So we've heard a lot about buyer's advocates because Kate's one of those, but we have a question here about vendor advocates. So I'm interested to know about vendor advocacy. We are selling a property and have been approached by a known buyer's advocate in our area who was offered to act as a vendor advocate. This isn't the first time we've sold. It's our fourth time, actually, and our most important. We haven't been overly happy with our agents in the past and could see the value this person could bring. The thing I can't reconcile is why an agent would do more for us at the request of our advocate when they're getting less commission because they have to share their commission. We are open to a new experience, and after two discussions with the advocate, we can see the knowledge base is high. We just don't know what to be careful of, and if we end up paying a higher commission, will be worth it. I'll go straight to Kate, who's our advocate expert. Kate, yeah. What do you reckon?
Interesting one. Let's for our listeners who haven't heard this term before, vendor advocate, and I can take a guess that this listener lives in Victoria because we use the word advocate instead of agent a lot. But anyway, regardless of where our listener is based, what's the difference between a vendor advocate and a selling agent? And it's an interesting question. A vendor advocate is someone who positions themselves as someone who's capable of running a campaign and coordinating which agent is getting involved and managing what that agent or overlooking or working alongside that agent to make sure that they're following all due processes in an effort to get the best result for the seller. Now, me personally, I don't do vendor advocacy and I don't really believe in it. And that's a very big statement to make. But I think when you've got the right agent, they want to get a great result for you. Firstly, because they're the right agent and they care about the result. They care about an ongoing relationship with you. They also want to do such a good job that their name is in bright lights and a great record has their name against it. You know, that's an agent's nirvana. And they also want fantastic word of mouth. So every opportunity for a selling agent leads to more selling opportunities if they do it right. It's the same in a lot of professions. So the real question is, can this vendor advocate add value? Now, our listeners identified that they can see the value add, and it's because they know the questions to ask. They understand the salesperson's set of protocols and tasks. They know when things are meant to happen, and they've probably had insight into many campaigns, and they've witnessed which selling agents have done really well and got great results and what they did to get it. However, does a vendor's advocate know more about selling agency than a selling agent? I say no. I think a good, experienced selling agent will know their stuff inside out. So the real question is whether the vendor's advocate spurs them on and motivates them and holds them accountable. Perhaps they do. I think the issue for a lot of consumers is how do I find that amazing selling agent? How do I get the best person? If you haven't got the time to interview them, you haven't got familiarity with the steps that they should be following, you might find that having a vendor advocate is a great way to help you make an informed decision. Me personally, though, I like giving a referral. I like personality matching. I like knowing who does a great job and who's going to work really effectively with that person for their property. And that's why I don't do it, for all of the reasons that our listener is concerned about.
Thank you, Kate. Very comprehensive answer. Dave?
Yeah, look, I think there's a time and a place for vendor advocates. Just as we're one of the first businesses to have buyer's agents in-house back in 2004, we also provided a vendor advocacy service for a number of years. It was called Sell Smart. I still own that domain, sellsmart.com.au, in case we ever dust it off the shelf or provide some education on it. So I think there is definitely a time and a place for the right seller, and you need to be selecting, obviously, a very competent person in this field. So look, some of the benefits of using a vendor's advocate include they can review the property to determine the right way the property should be sold. Now, that might be obvious in many occasions, but on some occasions it's not. So they might help you to decide whether it's best to be auctioned, private treaty, or some other method.
Can I ask a question though, Dave?
Yeah.
Do you reckon the selling agent would have an even better idea of that?
I think they should, 100%.
Absolutely.
So this is, I'll go through some of the benefits. Yeah, we'll talk about, you know, when they might work, when they may not work. How does that sound?
Perfect.
Number two, they can expect the property to determine its market value. So finding the best comparable sales, may also be able to find some sales results that are not yet released to the public, you know, that you may not be aware of or have access to. So to help you better understand than you might have been able to yourself where true value lies, and obviously save you time. And that's one of the big pieces of it too. It can save you a fair bit of time. Interviewing agents, appointing the preferred agent. Now, a good one should already know the best agents and be able to match them up to your property type and your personality, as Kate's already said. They should be able to also negotiate the fee on your behalf. Now, something that's really important is if they're getting their fee from the real estate agent's fee, the real estate agent may not work as hard because they're not getting paid as much. And so that was something we were always concerned about. So true to our values from day one in the business, we've always been fee for service. And that included for our vendor advocacy service. So if someone wanted to use our service, they paid us a fee. So we weren't cutting out some of the payment from the real estate agent who we worked with. So that's an important factor to consider as well. They'll help you develop, ensure that advertising campaign is right, help negotiate the campaign budget, including advertising methods and schedule, can give you a guide on how to present the property that you might be a bit unsure on. Obviously, negotiating the sale is a critical piece, and probably one of the most important factors is a top vendor advocate should be able to drag as much out of the marketplace as possible, whereas occasionally a real estate agent might cut and run because they just want to tie up the deal. So one of the things we found is we could actually drag a bit more out of the marketplace when we were providing that service than the real estate agent would have actually done. They would have called the sale a bit earlier, and often we would make the agent sweat a bit longer and actually get a bit more out of the marketplace in the negotiation. Now, saving time is a big one. If you're a time-poor professional, you certainly can get an education through the experience as well, and that might be really important to you. It can help minimize stress. They are some of the key benefits, but like any provision of service, you need to choose wisely and make sure it suits you.
100%. I always ask myself the question, what could go better and what could go wrong? And I've had enough experience dealing with vendors advocates on both sides of the coin. I was once a selling agent, and I remember what it was like dealing with vendor advocates. Were you excited about a lead when you had to give away a fair percentage of it, sometimes up to 50%? You're not very excited about that, especially if leads are abundant for you.
Yeah.
And the ones that do it badly can really make a mess of things. They can make it hard for the purchaser, hard for the agent, I've been on plenty of purchase assignments where the advocates got in the way. You know, they've tried to justify their existence and they've just been delayed with responding, or they've thrown 10 cents in and it was an irrelevant 10 cents. It can be really difficult. I've also worked with really great vendor advocates, and there's one in particular I refer consistently. She's absolutely amazing. And the thing that stands her apart is she's worked for a long time as a selling agent. So she intimately knows the process. She knows what gives way to a great result. She knows the issues that you can come across in a changing market. She's had hands-on experience. I think it's a real danger for a consumer to take on a vendor's advocate who has never worked in a selling agency. I think that's a real risk, because if you haven't worked in that environment, you really don't have the same exposure to what someone does who has. And the times that I've seen vendor advocacy work really well, there's quite a few examples, actually. Let's think about when you've got elderly people and they're transitioning. They've been in a home for 40 or 50 years. I know a good vendor advocate who assists with people selling their home and going into different residencies, so like retirement villages and things like that. And it's a different magical touch when you're dealing with someone like that, because you've got stakeholders, aka children. You've got a deadline, which is getting your fee up for going into the property, because they have very tight timeframes to work with. And you've got people that are vulnerable, probably way too trusting for their own good, and haven't dealt with selling agents for maybe 40 or 50 years. So that's a real privileged position to be in, because you're having to be very caring and across everything and deal with all these stakeholders and work under pressure. Now, the guy that I know who does that does it very well. He's very strong. He's very communicative with the agents, and most of all knows how to nurture the client that has no idea what's going on and just cares about getting their unit in the retirement village. So they're the situations that I come across where I think a vendor advocate is great. And likewise, someone trying to sell a property in an area that they're not familiar with. It might be, you know, selling a late parent's home interstate, or selling an investment that you haven't been very hands-on with. So they're some of the times that I think there's such a place for a vendor's advocate, but I'd really want to know what they're doing. And are they filling the gap that I need them to fill?
I think if I was going to boil it down, if you're looking for some time saving, if you're looking for peace of mind through the experience, and you have confidence that the person is going to drag more out of the marketplace, which is the best result overall and what you're looking for, which I've seen many times, then that is when they're going to add value. I would always be concerned if you're going to take some of the fee away from the real estate agent and potentially have them starting with a bad taste in their mouth from day one of the service they're providing, because they're sharing it with the vendor advocate.
Really good point. One important question, another important question to ask your vendor advocate is, how do you select the agents? What's your protocol? How many do you interview? What are you looking for? What say do I get in the process? Everybody does it differently. You really want to know, though, they're not flinging it to their mate.
Just a quick reminder, you can access our show notes, including links to all of the resources we talk about, on our website, which is propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au.
Excellent. All right. So let's continue with our advocacy theme. And now we're going to be talking about buyer's agents. So we just finished talking about vendors' advocates. Let's have a look at this list of questions about buyer's advocates. Hi, Kate, Pete and Dave. How important is it for a buyer's advocate to have local area expertise? Can a borderless buyer's advocate overcome lack of localised knowledge with data and analytics? Can you trust borderless buyer's advocates to recommend different locations to invest and also have them do the buying? Or should you first know where to invest and then pick a BA that works in the area? And if it's the latter, as in you should work out where you need to invest, how would you know where to invest in the first place? So we got lots of questions there, but I know the host is not supposed to say too much, but I'd just like to chime in just quickly with a very relevant and recent example. Somebody rang me last week asking if I could help them with buying a property. And I work virtually full-time at uni, so I don't have a lot of time for that. But the property was in Victoria. Well, I think I know a good buyer's agent in Victoria, and even better, she wanted to buy in Ballarat. Well, I said, have I got the person for you? Because, like, even though I know Ballarat, right, I've been there a few times, I don't know the best parts of Ballarat to buy real estate. I don't know the best streets. I don't know what sorts of properties to be looking for, as in the types of properties tenants want, but I'm sure Kate does. So that's just my 5 cents worth, but I'm sure Kate and Dave, you have a lot more to say about that. Seeing that Kate started off with the last question, Dave, I'll get you to start off with this one.
No problems, Pete. So, look, this goes to the heart of our business, really, and one of the key reasons why we remove buyer's agents from my service, being one of the pioneers of providing a buyer's advocacy service way back in 2004 through to 2011, the reality was if we wanted to provide property plans for people and develop a property strategy that was location agnostic, well, I didn't believe we could have buyer's agents in-house, because the reality was we're always going to recommend our buyer's agents buy the properties for our clients. And when we were doing that, we were only focusing on Melbourne. And Melbourne isn't always the best city for your next purchase. And I almost forgot we had one in Sydney as well. So I'll just go through each of the questions. How important is it for a BA to have local area expertise? Look, I think it's very important. And the buyer's agents who we refer our clients to are always local agents around the country. Can a borderless BA overcome lack of knowledge with data and analytics? Personally, I don't believe so. I think on the ground knowledge is something that's impossible to replace. And I'm not going to go into the detail of that, but I just think logistically, it's really difficult to do. Can you trust borderless BAs to recommend different locations to invest and also have them do the buying? Personally, as I've said, it's not my preference. I wouldn't use them myself, and we never recommend them to our clients. We only recommend, as I've said, locally based, those who are locally based and on the ground. That is one of the prerequisites when we have a client strategy for their next purchase that is best suited to a city they don't live in. So again, we only refer to local buyer's agents. Should you know where to invest, then pick a BA that works in the area. Yes, 100%. That is how our property plan process works. So step one, the plan should come first, followed by step two, the strategy for your next purchase. And then step three is property selection and therefore selection of the buyer's agent in our process. Now, obviously, if you choose to go directly to a buyer's agent first, then they can work with you with the strategy and the selection and maybe even a plan. But sadly for most people, they skip having a plan and ensuring the strategy for their next purchase fits within that plan. So the last question is, if it's the latter, which is a great question, how would you know where to invest in the first place? Now, that goes to the methodology that we use with our property plan, which is a longer answer, which maybe given I've sort of answered a number of the questions there, maybe we can cross back to Kate with some of those other questions and I can come back to our methodology for how to answer that last question.
Excellent. Awesome.
Yeah, I totally agree, Dave. I'm going to actually go back to front here and start briefly on the last question.
Okay.
What the difference between borderless investing and using a borderless buyer agent, there's such chalk and cheese. Borderless investing obviously implies that you're happy to have a portfolio that spans outside of your own state or capital city. And I think that's great for diversification more than anything. When people say it's about land tax, wrong. Avoiding land tax is a benefit, but it's not a reason. And I think being prepared to consider what fits your strategy is really important. And when you do a proper property plan, they're taking into account all the metrics, the things that a lot of people don't have at their fingertips. Now, I know where to look. Pete knows where to look. Dave certainly knows where to look, but not everyone does. So you've got purchase price, rate of capital growth, outgoings, the type of yield you could get, the rate of change of that yield. You know, if rents are volatile, we need to know that. And also, most importantly, what sort of vacancy rates you're dealing with and the type of tenant. And if you're looking at properties that need maintenance. So they're all of the things that come down to strategy. And that's where I'm going to leave it, because Dave can unpack that. Without giving all of those elements thought, you're skipping a really important point. if you're going into an area just on a speculative basis, you know, I've heard that such and such might be going into this city and I think I could make a quick buck, that's property trading and that's not what we talk about on this show. I've seen some people do it well, but you're introducing a high level of risk. So back to the first question, how important is it for BA to have local area expertise? I think it's critical. I really do. And I know people that do borderless purchasing, and I know some that do it very well because they're very familiar with the areas that they go into, even though they don't live there. But I know plenty that get on a jet and literally have Google Maps running. I think that's terrible. If I need Google Maps to get to an area, I'm probably not the right person. If the agent doesn't know me really well, doesn't know how I have my coffee, well, that's not as ideal. So you're getting the drift. I know the agents I'm dealing with, which is half of the battle. You know their style, you're on side with them. I also know some of the little details around the pockets that I work in that aren't so great. So let's talk about them, the things that we'd rather avoid. You've got to have a really good, strong idea of an area, particularly if someone's really fussy with their homeowner brief and they've told you all the things that they don't want to be near or what they value. You've got the expertise to deliver that, to point out your concerns if you've had a good dialogue with them and you're familiar with your area. If it's an investment and you get something wrong, you're impacting people's wealth. So how can a borderless BA overcome lack of localised knowledge with data and analytics? I don't think you can. And I'll share an example with you. Pete, you mentioned Ballarat. I do Ballarat. I've been doing Ballarat for over a decade. I don't do Bendigo. If someone wanted to buy a home in Bendigo and they've found it, I can negotiate it for sure. But can I instruct them about Bendigo? No, because I've probably only been there 50 times. I need to be really familiar with an area, not 50 times familiar, really familiar. So Ballarat, at one stage I was going up there every week and I did a lot of on-the-ground legwork before I got started catering to clients in Ballarat. There are streets I avoid. There are pockets I avoid. There are places that some property managers won't take the rental. The last thing you want to do is go into an area and then scramble to find a property manager who wants to deal with that headache area. There's a postcode in Ballarat that spans two segments, and one segment I don't want to ever buy in. The other segment's great. Now, if you don't know the difference and it's marketed as the same suburb on realestate.com and you're buying remotely and your advocate doesn't know what they're doing, you might be buying in that dodgy patch. These are just some of the things. And then it comes down to knowing your local market. Circling back to Ballarat, proximity to shops and cafes and station is not what drives them. That's what drives Melburnians. Ballarat people like warmth. It's really cold up there. A lot of tenants in particular suburbs love a secure backyard because we've got kids and pets. Powered sheds, massive one. If you've got a giant four-car garage powered shed, man cave with room for a pool table and a fridge, your tenant might never, ever leave. So it's just having that local expertise and knowing what tenants value, what property managers need from you and when not to buy that makes a huge difference to someone's success.
Dave before was saying, looking at the data and the analytics. I mean, we can all do research off the net and see what's happening, but that local knowledge is so important. I remember I was doing some research on gentrification, and one of the indicators of gentrification is an increase in the number of people with bachelor degrees. And I was looking at a suburb which just did not have the characteristics of gentrifying, but the number of people with bachelor degrees had skyrocketed from one census period to another. Now, I live in the local area and I realised that a theological college had opened up offering master's courses. Well, the only way you do a master's course is if you've already got an undergraduate degree. And so people with undergraduate degrees that wanted to study there flooded the area, therefore increasing the numbers. Another indicator is median price, and the median price shot up more than the other adjacent areas. Well, the reason was a new subdivision had gone in. And people pay a premium for new properties just like they pay a premium for new cars. So that was a reason why median price had shot up, not because the existing stock had gone up in value so much. So really, it's not unless you're a local that you would understand this. And you could easily tick the 10 boxes that you need to tick to buy a property. And that's doing your quantitative research. But the qualitative research, in particular the local knowledge, you really need somebody with boots on the ground to work out, like Kate was saying. It's got the same postcode, but are they really the same suburb or the same area? Dave, anything else to add in our advocates edition of our podcast?
If you think about just the financial metrics, like the cost of flying to that state, are you staying overnight in that state? You know, the cost of the accommodation. So, you know, something's got to give. If you're charging the same price for working interstate, you know, there's extra time cost, there's extra cost to the person providing the service. So how do they shortcut that? How do they still provide the same service and create the same profit for the business with those extra overheads for providing the service to the individual buyer, let alone all the challenges of being an expert on the ground? I think logistically and practically, you can't do it to the same skill as someone who's local, can be there day in, day out. But just to the last question, so should you know where to invest and then pick a BA that works in the area, which is our process?
Yes, my process. I refer all the time.
So how would you know where to invest in the first place? So that's a really good question. So if you have a plan, then the strategy for your next purchase is much clearer. So some of the key factors that determine what we call the macro location, which essentially is the city, in terms of the decision-making sequence, which we include in our property planning process, are some of the following. Okay, firstly, is it going to be in a lifestyle or investment purchase? Now, if it's going to be a lifestyle or home purchase, usually the person knows the city they want to buy in, so that's pretty straightforward. But if it's an investment, okay, will you sell any of your existing properties? You've got to answer that question. What is your budget? How does that align with your cash flow, your available funds and equity, what we call your money goals? Because it broadly needs to align with the median of the macro location, the city, and then the suburbs that are selected. So the budget plays a critical part, and sometimes that can cross out some cities and include some cities. And if you don't happen to be living in a city where your budget aligns with purchasing a quality asset, well, then, you know, you should be looking further afield if you want to purchase the best quality asset. Fourth, where do you own existing properties? You know, so factoring in considerations such as diversification, such as managing market cycle risk, because historically all the capital cities don't move at the same time. Do you own any assets in some of Australia's strongest long-term capital cities and markets? Land tax is a consideration. It's certainly not the sole consideration, as Kate very clearly stated before. What kinds of existing properties do you own as well should be factored into it. Really importantly, what's your rental goal for retirement? How much gross rent are you receiving currently? How many more properties is it likely you will purchase to be able to hit, need to purchase to be able to hit your retirement goal? That can factor into the price point and therefore obviously the location. So from working through the above and some of the other factors Kate's already mentioned, we usually are able to narrow it down to 1 to 3 macro locations, sometimes even more. And then we provide commentary around the pros and cons of each. And in consultation with our client, we agree on a city to target. Once the above is determined, you can also get clarity through that journey on the asset type and then narrow in on obviously the micro locations, the suburbs within that capital city. Now, look, absolutely mindful, no one has a crystal ball. There is no perfect answer to this, but there is a methodology to go through to come up with a city and a strategy that the client is happy with and they're empowered to make that decision through that journey. From there, we absolutely, if you're buying interstate, suggest you best to work with a local buyer's agent and then we'll refer to a local buyer's agent. But if you choose to buy interstate yourself, which I think, and we've already covered, is hard for a buyer's agent, let alone the average punter, we can support people to do that. But that high level is our journey and methodology within the property plan.
That's David, great stuff, Dave. Very detailed stuff. Kate?
You touched on something before, and we haven't explored legislation and licensing, and I think it's good to pop this in. Our real estate license is estate-based, and so as a buyer's agent, I hold the same real estate agency license as a selling agent. That's how Victoria works. And if I want to work in another state, I can apply for another state license. I might have some exams to do. I might have some applications to to go through in order to get recognition for prior learning, whatever it might be, I can organise that. But I've got to go and do that. So if you're going borderless and your agent doesn't have a licence in that state, warning bells, massive warning bells, because they're operating illegally. And the thing that goes with that is the legislation, because every state is different. So understanding all of the different forms and the contracts of sale, and, you know, we've got a vendor statement or a Section 32 in Victoria. I listen to other BAs talking about how they understand the legislation and can nimbly coordinate things with a deep understanding of that. Me, for example, with when to put in an offer, pre-auction offers because of our three-day either side of an auction, cooling off period, not being around, and just the nitty-gritty of how our law works. Having a really firm understanding of that helps me be so nimble and act so quickly, sometimes taking opposition buyers by storm and getting my offer across the line when otherwise it might not have if I didn't time it perfectly or use the clauses and conditions I've used. So I always think there's such a degree of art and science in that, with understanding the legislation and how it all works. So you'd want to make sure that your borderless BA really has their head around the other states that they're operating in before you get excited about it.
Excellent. Thank you very much for that, Kate. One last comment there, Dave.
Oh, look, I'm just going to double down. It's a really good point Kate makes. I mean, there's a reason real estate agency licenses are state-based and conveyancers and solicitors the same thing, because there's so much to understand in the detail within any given state, let alone being an expert across multiple states around the legalities of everything to do with property purchasing.
And it's not even clauses and conditions in contracts and auction rules. It's also our town planning legislation. You're understanding how our certificates look and where the easements are and what all the terminology is for our zoning. Pete, you throw up stuff about subdivision in Adelaide. I don't understand South Australian legislation or town planning laws. You absolutely know it inside out, and we've got different terms. I think it's critical.
It is. It is. All right. That's been an excellent discussion on buyer's advocates and also vendor's advocates. I know the host is not supposed to give a gold nugget, but if I could just summarise the local buyer's agent question we've just talked about, I think it's really important to get a local buyer's agent, because location is the most critical aspect of making money in property. So that's my, again, another 5 cents worth.
I think that was at least 50 cents worth, Pete.
That's good. That was really good.
Please don't go away, as Kate and Dave will come back with their gold nuggets very shortly.
If you've enjoyed our podcast, leave a review on iTunes and share the episode with your friends.
Now it's time for us to go mining for our gold nugget property tip of the day.
Dave, what's your gold nugget?
My gold nuggets is, particularly if you own multiple properties or you plan to build a multi-property portfolio, getting your property plan clear is step one to then allow you to determine the strategy that's right for your next purchase each time you come to purchase, because as I've said many times over the journey, your next purchase is always the most important one.
Excellent. Thanks, Dave. Kate, your gold nugget?
When it comes to borderless BAs, I think the most important thing to understand is why you're going into a particular area. So if you've got a really firm strategy, you understand all of the metrics, and you're confident that that person has the skill set to tackle that city or that region and know the legislation inside out, then you can rest comfortably that you're making a good decision. But if it's a decision that's spontaneous or personality-based, or if it's speculative, worse still, you've really got to rethink things.
Excellent. Thank you very much for that, Kate. Thank you too, Dave. And thank you, listeners, for joining us for another episode of the Thanks for joining us on another episode of the Property Planner, Buyer and Professor. And we look forward to having you with us next week. Bye for now. If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to learn more about some of the themes discussed, take a listen to episode 7, how to assess and select property like an A-grade buyer's agent. Episode 14, how to choose a location for investment, what to look for and what to avoid. Episode 21, why price points should determine location and strategy. Episode 53, diversification 101, how and why to plan for diversification within your property portfolio. And episode 77 and 117, Understanding the Real Estate Agent Behaviours That Buyers Don't Like, Parts 1 and 2.
Thank you for joining the property planner, David Johnston, whose company Property Planning Australia provides the only independent pure planning advisory in Australia that does not buy or sell property, insurance, investment or super product.
And the property buyer, Kate Bacos, recently awarded Buyer's Agent of the Year and an owner of an independent buyer's agency in Melbourne's Inner West. And of course, the property professor, Peter Kalizos, Australia's leading property university lecturer, Chairman of Property Investment Professionals of Australia and seasoned investor and developer.
We've really enjoyed delivering this podcast and we'd love you to join us on our podcast webpage at propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au or our Facebook page. Feel free to send us any questions and Dave, Pete and I will answer them for you.
So until next time, remember that each property decision you make is leading you towards your ideal lifestyle.
Everything we talk about in this episode is general in nature and should not be considered to be financial advice. We've put a lot of effort into making sure the information is accurate, but please don't rely on this information to make a decision. If you're looking for specific advice, please seek the help of a specialist and remember, it's important you determine your trusted advisors are independent.